Welcome to the Lost Together podcast. First, let's meet the host. Matt Wardlaw has been interviewing, writing, and talking about music in print and on the radio for over 20 years. The Lost Together podcast features in-depth discussion and debate with special guest contributors and also conversations with artists, producers, and music industry professionals. New and classic artists join us to share stories and insights regarding their musical process. Let's get started.
Welcome to another episode of the podcast. This week for episode 9, we welcome Alex Deason of the Damwells. Alex has a new self-titled solo album, his first full-length solo debut, which we'll get into in a second. But first, I thought I'd share with you the moment where I came across Alex's music. It was this song.
Something to offer, it's never been in demand. Yeah, I got something to say to you that I know you'd rather ignore. I am the bastard of midnight, I might just sleep outside this door. Trouble keeps the bar light song for the heartache.
Bastard of Midnight came off the Damwells record One Last Century, which was an album that they gave away for free via Paste Magazine. And when I heard those lyrics, "Trouble keeps the bar lights on for the heartache," I knew that I was going to be a fan for a long time. I did an interview in 2011 with Alex, along with my Pop Dose comrade Michael Parr, to talk about No One Listens to the Band Anymore, the next Damwells record that came along, and we discussed that record and One Last Century. Since then, Alex went on to record a series of 4 solo EPs and make a new album with the original lineup of the Damwells, and it was that same grouping of players that also toured for the first time in a number of years. Now we've got this new solo record, which is going to be released by Rock Ridge Music on February 12th, and the new album was once again funded by a Pledge Music campaign, and you can pre-order the record now via Pledge. If you pre-order the record prior to the release date, you're going to receive an interesting incentive, a download of all the music that Alex has released to date, both solo and with the Damwells. The download is a bit of a primer playlist for a live-streamed event that Alex is going to do the day before the record comes out on February 11th in Nashville. He's planning to perform his entire catalog of music from various locations in the city, and that's going to culminate in a full album performance of the new record. Alex is in an interesting place, as you'll hear from this interview. It seems like this solo album is definitely the start of something that Alex views as a new chapter in his career, and something that will be a template for how he wants to work and write songs going forward. If you're a longtime Damwells fan, I think you'll be interested to hear what he has to say and what that might mean for the future of the group. You'll get a taste of the record via a couple tracks that we're going to play during today's podcast. We'll start with Ode to Ex-Girlfriends, which leads off the record, and we'll wrap up the podcast with one more song. This is the last song I'll ever write on this guitar. In between, there's a lot of things to talk about. Let's start with the music.
Kelly was the girl on the top swing. She gave me nicknames and paintings. Her father was dying of something that she didn't understand. He was a great cook and a kind man. Always once a year, usually when the snow appears, I look her. She never replies, probably wishes I would die. I left her for my now ex-wife. To all the lovers I wrote love letters, and all their mothers who bought me nice sweaters, to all them I hereby extend this ode to ex-girlfriends. Ashley was the girl from Cambridge. She was a vegan and brutally honest. Her mother was French and never liked me, I could always tell. We saw a jazz band in a hotel. But when I'm in Chicago, we get dairy-free gelato and she looks sad. I wish you were happy, she says, and I just start laughing. Jesus, I'm just fine. But she knows I'm mine. To all the lovers, I wrote love letters. And all their mothers who bought me a nice sweater. To all them, I hereby extend this ode to ex-girlfriends. Laura was the girl in the boy's pants. She was a big fan of They Might Be Giants. Her parents were Cuban and Spanish, hair just like a willow tree that I would climb in when she kissed me. We said we would meet in 1998 in Central Park. And right there in the snow, she was standing all alone like Alice and that wonder. To all the lovers, I wrote love letters. And all the mothers who bought me nice sweaters. To all them, I hereby extend this ode to ex-girlfriends. Elizabeth was the girl from the east side. We never dated, but kissed a few times. We used to get high after school when her parents were out of town. I'd tickle her arm till I passed out. I saw her at a bar stumbling into someone's car 5 years later. She kissed me on the neck but was aiming for my cheek. Her hair smelled sweet and she died the next week. To all the lovers, I wrote love letters. To all the mothers who bought me nice sweaters. And to all them, I hereby extend this ode to ex-girlfriends. This ode to ex-girlfriends. This ode to ex-girlfriends.
And now, here's our chat with Alex Deason. We begin by talking about the Damwells being one of the first bands to use pledge music and where things went from there. I hope you enjoy it.
And at the time, that was not a thing that was common. Pledge had just started. Benji had reached out to me about this thing he was working on, and I don't even think their website had launched yet when we started talking. So that was the beginning of kind of a new era for me and for us. You know, we've made three records with fan funding, two Damwells and one solo record that's coming out in February. So that was the beginning of a new era of the music business, I guess, or at least the Damwells music business side of things. So it was a good time. The tour for that record was great. You know, I had Harper Blinn, this great band, backing me, and you know, we had a great, we could sing really well, and we had these great harmonies, and you know, it was a great time. And then, you know, then life kind of happened. I graduated from the workshop and moved back to Los Angeles, you know, promptly got divorced, and then started doing a bunch of co-writing stuff, you know, wrote some songs for some other people, and then finally started working on some new music for myself, which was actually the Damwells record was first, and then I went and made the EPs after the Damwells record was completed because I knew that the Damwells record wasn't going to come out until 2015, even though it had been finished at the end of 2013. So throughout 2014, I just, I guess as a act of desperation, put out some EPs because I wanted to go out and play shows. You know, it was not the happiest of times for me, so I wanted to go out and play shows and, you know, make music and do what I do the only thing that's been good to me, I guess.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about that because, like, on paper, you know, you talked about this, but it's like there were the four solo EPs in 2014. I mean, there's the new Damwell's record in 2015, and now there's the new solo album as we enter 2016. And on paper, it would seem like you've got the ability to put out plenty of new music at a rate that would satisfy your creative pace. But you spoke to this a little bit, but like knowing that, for instance, the songs on this new record were, I guess, written about a year ago and recorded during January or February of last year, I wondered how true it is to say that.
To say what?
To say that, like, you know, you were able to put out, you know, music at a rate that satisfies your creative pace. Do you feel like you're always working a little bit behind, even in this kind of, like, this new music industry?
I mean, I've always felt like I'm, I mean, I guess when you say behind, you mean, like, having made recordings but waiting to release them?
It's just, it's a pretty, like, when you look at, like, what you've put out in the past, you know, almost 3 years, I mean, you've put out a lot of music, but, you know, hearing mm-hmm. you talk about, like, when some of this stuff was, you know, done and completed, it's obvious that there still is a waiting game of some kind at certain points.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's horrible. And that's the worst part of this whole thing, is that you write a record or even just a song,
mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you're like, cool, that's done. That will probably maybe come out in the next 5 years. And by the time that you actually release the record, whatever was exciting and interesting about that song has grown completely inert. And it's, you know, whatever I had said or however I felt about that song at that moment has passed. So the solo record, when I started writing it in January, you know, I literally wrote the first lyrics on January 1st and then came home and just wrote and recorded the entire record from January 1st to February 18th. And it just kind of all came out very quickly. And I think because I was in a creative state of mind and, you know, I don't know why, it just happened that way. And so I started planning to release this record as soon as I finished it. Because I knew it was going to be 1 year. You know, it usually takes 1 year from the completion of a project until it's released, if you're lucky. And so I was just going to sort of force the hand of my label and of myself, I guess, and just make sure that the record was out in a year. And then as soon as I finished that record, I started recording another record from March to June. So that record's done and it's being mixed.
Oh, cool.
So the idea is to have another record out this year as well. You know, being in a band like the Damwells, which has been awesome, you can't just release stuff all the time because you have to go in the studio where there's a drums and there's an engineer and the guitar player has to come in, the bass player has to come in, and, you know, everybody has to do their parts. But, you know, I've been making music on my own long before I was ever in a band. So I'm trying to go back to that state of mind only now. I mean, hopefully I'm better at recording myself than I was when I was, you know, 15 or whatever. But I'm trying to go back to that idea of just putting stuff out. I mean, I don't know why the urgency is now, but I think it probably comes from having to wait for so long to put stuff out, having to organize the troops and get us in the studio, find funding and that whole thing, and dealing with other people and their, you know, personalities or their conflicts or their children or their babysitters or wives or, you know, which is all fine. It's all part of that process. But I just, you know, now that I'm free from that, I just want to put stuff out and I don't need anybody else to do that. And I don't want anybody else involved. Because I just want to just keep sort of putting out the stuff that I've been chewing on for the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean songs. You know, these are all new songs. These are not songs that have been sitting around. But certainly there's been an active, you know, furnace going that has been wanting to, you know, to kick stuff out, you know, to make stuff happen. So I just want to keep that fire going, and I don't want to be held back by anything.
Well, and it seems like, too, with the subject matter of some of these songs, that there are some, you know, deep-rooted issues that you felt really comfortable bringing to the surface and getting out on the table with this record?
Yeah, I didn't feel very comfortable doing it. I just I ran out of you know, love songs, I guess.
Interesting. So what was the process that you go through with yourself to, you know, really open up the door and put stuff like this out there?
I mean, to be totally honest, sometimes if I write a lyric and it makes me upset, then I know I'm doing something right, I guess. If I, you know what I mean? If I write something that, that reveals too much or even makes me, you know, start to weep or something.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but that's usually a pretty good indication that I've hit on something that, that affects me. You know, I think that a lot of songwriters, especially in the pop world, because, you know, that's something that I had been doing for a while, was writing songs, you know, pop songs for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is a guessing game. It's like, part of it is, you know, probably 30% of it is trying to guess the headspace of the artist. Like, you know, if it was Justin Bieber or something, or if it was Kelly Clarkson, you're trying to guess what they want to sing about. What does Kelly Clarkson, Justin Bieber want to sing? And then also you have to make music that will appeal to a wide variety of people, you know, pop music. And so you have to sort of find a middle ground. When I write songs for myself, I am exclusively indebted as far as the quality or the output to myself. I'm only looking to move me. And the idea is that if I'm moved by something that I made, as egotistical as that may sound, but if I'm moved by something that I've created, then the hope is that it would move someone else. And that the universal kind of, how do I say this? The universal appeal of a song starts with the appeal internally from the creator, you know?
Sure.
Stepping back from the painting and saying, like, wow, that's really, that, I think that really says something, you know, or whatever. That painting or sculpture or song. And so if that happens, then I feel like, then someone else will feel that way. And if I go as deep as I possibly can on the lyrical side of it, because the music and the melody is bullshit, you know, who cares? Anybody can write these melodies or, you know, play these chords. That's all just a color. You know what I mean? But what's being displayed really with the color, which is the melody of music, is the theme or the essence of it. You know, and the essence of it really is about the lyrics. So if I can figure out a way to say something that's deeply personal to me and moves me, you know, then I feel like hopefully it'll move someone else. Otherwise I can't write songs anymore that are like, you know, there's a song on the last Dan Wells record called fuck, what is it called? Heavy Heart.
Yeah, okay.
The song Heavy Heart, right?
Yep.
And it's like this kind of like fun kind of like, she's got a heavy heart, so you gotta start making love you. I kind of thought of it as like a Faces kind of song. Wake up, Maggie, I think I've got something to say to you. Which is like, you know, kind of like this story of, you know, love lost or, you know, it's something that people can relate to very easily. And it's kind of lighthearted. You know, Maggie, I don't think it's quite as lighthearted as my song, but I don't think I can write songs like that anymore. Because I think that those songs are like, you know, when I'm writing that song or when I'm coming up with the arrangement with the band and stuff, we're thinking about performing it live and people really enjoying it and dancing around and having a good time. And I just don't give a fuck about that anymore. I don't care if anybody dances around. I don't even care if anybody shows up. So I can only really, and I just don't think I can do that very well, is really the real truth. That's why I don't want to write songs like that anymore, and why I probably won't. I'm just not good at it. I can't remember the words when I play them live because they're meaningless. I can't remember the chords when I'm playing it live because it's just an imitation of something else. So I just don't think I can do that stuff anymore. When I started rehearsing this new record, you know, I hadn't played the songs for 7 or 8 months, and I remember them immediately. I know all the words. I mean, you know, I will probably fuck them up at some point, but I knew them. You know, I'd retained that stuff. And I'd started to discover probably about 6 or 7 years ago but I was unable to retain the lyrics or the chords or the melodies to songs that didn't mean anything to me. But because, you know, I was scripted in this band and we had this thing that we do, you know, I would rehearse them and try to remember them and stuff. Make little marks in the set list, you know, like, oh, the beginning of this verse starts with this lyric. So I just don't think I can do stuff like that anymore. I have to go as deep as I possibly can into, you know, my experience, and try to go past the idea of trying to make something that is appealing universally, and instead of going further and deeper than that and trying to find something that really, you know, kind of dredges the bottom of my experience and pulls it out into a song. That's probably the longest answer you've ever received to any questions you've ever asked. And I apologize. And you can edit it as you feel free.
The current records that you have to shoot for are, I talked to a guy one time that I asked him a question and he talked for 90 minutes. And
Jesus Christ.
The guy right behind him talked for 70 minutes. So I think you're doing okay.
Okay, good. I mean, the truth is, I'm like, before, when I put out records before, I would kind of prepare for interviews and like, I'd even have like a little piece of paper, you know, just sort of like, okay, here's the bullet points.
Yep.
You know, like, stuff I can come back to. Like with the last Dan Wells record, like this was a redemption record where the four of us were going to get back into the studio for the first time in 7 years, like the brothers that we were, and kind of make music that we love and enjoy each other's company and have a great experience. You know, that was something I kept returning to because that's what I felt about that record.
Mm-hmm.
But for this record, I feel like I'm totally unprepared for everything because I want to just, you know, I just want to just lay it out there as it comes out. I mean, I have a pretty good idea of how I feel about it, but unfortunately, it's not scripted.
Well, it just seems like, from what you said about, like, you know, how you felt about the last record, like it being like a redemption kind of thing, and where your head's at now, I mean, it kind of seems like obviously two different places. So I guess the obvious question that I'll just ask is that, like, you know, when you talk about the types of songs that you want to write and the types of songs that you don't want to write going forward, do you think is there a way for you to write songs the way you want to write songs now and create them as Damwell's music?
No. That's why I made the solo record. You know, can I write Damwell songs again? I don't know. I don't know. That's all. I mean, all I know is that I kind of just feel like I've gotten to step out and away from that, with this new solo record and then with the record that I made that's not out yet, that I just feel like, and you know, my thoughts always go back to the Damwells. You know, they're like my family. So I always think like, oh, you know, maybe the Damwells could play these songs. I know Steve is a big fan, the drummer, you know, he loves all the solo stuff that I've been doing. And, you know, he wants to play on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he would be great. He'd be great on it. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know if, I just don't know. We're so loud, which is fun and everything. But, for now I'm just stepping out from behind the curtain, I guess. I'm just sort of going at it with this solo ideology.
That makes perfect sense. And I want to go back to something you mentioned, and that was how you've started doing a lot more co-writing with and for other artists. And I was curious how you've seen that kind of feedback into your own songwriting and if you think that contributes to, like, say, just the volume of songwriting that you've been doing over the past few years and the music that we've, you know, heard from you, you know, with these three records and EPs. Or I should say the two records and the set of four EPs that came before that.
I mean, it's been a huge influence in that I hate doing it so much that that I have turned completely away from, you know, from popular music of that nature and writing these completely ridiculous, just flaccid lyrics that I... And it's actually made, I think that's probably what's helped me to get really deep into, you know, my own story and writing lyrics that you know, that are about me in a deeper sort of narrative way. Yeah, I mean, it's, I just remember going to sessions and just feeling like a traitor. I mean, just feeling like a fraud. and knowing that the people that I was writing for were complete frauds. But again, that's, you know, my definition of what it is to be an artist or a songwriter. You know, that's not someone else's definition. So according to my definition, it felt like a betrayal. You know, the money was green and stuff, and I like that part of it. But, you know, it's like Vegas. I mean, it's like your odds of getting a hit song are, you know, the odds are so against you that it's just almost not worth it. And there's so many people out there writing songs for other people. I mean, it is a shit show. And none of them, well, not none of them, but, I mean, you know, well, I can say none of them are experts, you know? I mean, it's like a, you know, how can you be an expert at, you know, painting an abstract painting or whatever? So it's just, you know, it's a brutal business. And popular music is just like this Ouroboros snake. It just keeps eating itself and regurgitating itself and eating itself and regurgitating itself. It's the same shit. And it's fucking horrible. I mean, it's horrible. And I don't mean that in like a flippant, like, it sucks. Like, I think it's destructive to our culture, you know? And it's just, it's mind numbingly inert. And I hate, you know, art or whatever, songs that are inert. You know, I'd rather someone just like, you know, I don't know. I'd rather we were back in the times when monks were setting themselves on fire in the streets of Vietnam than sitting around, you know, listening to Katy Perry. It's like, it's a waste of time.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's a new book by John Seabrook called The Song Machine: Inside the Hit Factory, which examines the process of making hit songs today. And I heard an interview that he did about the book where they talked about how in that area of music making, you know, like Katy Perry, as you mentioned, and other folks, you know, the days of there being only a couple people listed in the credits are in a lot of cases gone. I mean, there's people making beats or whatever they're doing that each one of those people, they end up with a credit on the song. And as someone who I assume you came up writing songs, obviously in the more quote unquote traditional way, where it's you and maybe one or other, two other people that are on the credits, and you know, what piece of that song that each of those other couple people have, I think that's got to be a pretty interesting pool for you to get into.
I mean, yeah, I have that book, and I read most of it. You know, I would have read more of it, but I just feel like, you know, it was just confirming all the things that I believed about being a songwriter in the pop world. Yeah, I mean, songs are written by committee. I mean, could you imagine like Jackson Pollock painting a you know, full 5 and 5 by committee?
Or even Jackson Brown, you know?
Or Jackson Brown, yeah. I mean, any of these, or even Madonna. I mean,
yeah.
You know, those songs are written by probably, you know, I don't know how the songwriting totals are, but they're certainly not fucking 7 or 12. You
mm-hmm.
know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it sucks. It's, you know, it's just, you know, this is what happens when art and commerce meet, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, someone's got to die, you know, and the dollar isn't going anywhere. So yeah, it's depressing. I mean, the truth is that, a lot of the people that consume that music are young kids. And that's why I think that it's destructive in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Just cause I don't think it gives the people a lot of, hope in listening to this music, to do anything other than continue to listen to the music, you know what I mean? It's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. When I was a kid, I was listening to, you know, Fleetwood Mac. I was listening to, you know, we came up in the 90s. There was like Pearl Jam and there was Nirvana. And, you know, a lot of those songs were fucking hopeless, you know, like, or didn't make any sense. But there was something in it that really touched some inexplicable place, you know, mentally, intellectually. That sparked an insane amount of creativity among the people of my generation, I believe. You know, I think like when Kurt Cobain said things like, "I'm so salad," you're just kind of like, what does that mean? It would spark something in you that would be you know, inspiring.
Yeah.
And I just don't feel like anybody's listening to this music and feeling inspired to do anything other than make that music. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's an Ouroboros snake. That's when culture starts to crumble. It's when it starts to imitate itself, you know, on a one-to-one level. You know, that's a problem. when you don't have any outliers, when you don't have any, you know, any other, I think we start to get a little too wrapped up in eating our tail. So, yeah, that book is depressing.
It is.
You know, making songs by committee is, it just sucks. You know, it just sucks. It's like strip mining. You know, it's like, sure, you're going to make a lot of money, but you're going to leave the landscape barren. You know, I don't want to leave the landscape barren.
No, absolutely not. I mean, can you give us an example, like, say, like the Bieber track? Like, you know, what's your part in a collaboration like that? How did that lay out?
You know, I wrote the music, and then I collaborated with the two other guys on the lyrics and the melody. More of the lyrics, probably, than the melody.
Mm-hmm.
Ross Golan and Jay Hart were, like, really, really good at finding those pop melodies. And I like those guys. You know, I'm still very close with Ross, and, you know, and Jay Hart's a great songwriter. I've worked with him as well. But... And at the time, I was really excited because I was like, oh, the prospect of Justin Bieber, like, you know, performing one of my songs or recording one of my songs is great. I was probably even convinced for a moment that it was great beyond the monetary gain that I would see from it. But it was great in a sort of like a, in an intellectual way, that it was like a great accomplishment. You know, like, I don't know, like catching a fucking sperm whale. You know, like it was like a great accomplishment. It made me feel, you know, satisfied with myself. But it just, you know, I mean, I appreciate it, I guess. Or do I? I don't even know. Certainly, I appreciate the time that I was able to spend with those guys. I mean, that's really what I'd like to do. I'd like to make music. I don't like to negotiate percentages. You know what I mean? Why should I give this person percentage when they didn't write anything? Why should I give this person percent? You know, it's like that whole nonsense is, you know, it's kind of shitty. So that part I didn't really like. But you know, I really like writing with them. And the truth is that, you know, I've met a lot of people through the process of co-writing who are now some of my best friends. And I really enjoy collaborating with them. You know, I really do. And it makes the process a little less insufferable because, you know, if I'm hanging out with my friend Sandy or if I'm hanging out with my friend Garrison and we're writing together, we're just kind of doing this beautiful thing together that's awesome. And maybe someone will dig it, you know. I just did a song with my friend Sandy Keela and Garrison Starr that was on the show Nashville. And that was just a great experience with the three of us getting together and writing the song. You know, I mean, I'm a pretty like headstrong person, you know, as is Sandy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, sometimes there can be some conflict. I mean, not like, fuck you, man, but there can be like, no, man, I think that stinks, man. You know, stuff like that. But that's, it just makes me feel alive, you know, makes me feel good. So that part of it is really great. But that's, you know, that's completely different than the other side of it, which is hanging out with these people, going to these clubs, you know, being fucked up all the time or whatever. Or I mean, I just don't listen to that music. I don't listen to Justin Bieber. So, you know, whatever I have to offer, I'm happy to do. But I, you know, I guess I'm not happy to do it. But, I mean, I was happy to do it at the time.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of what I wondered was that, like, using the Bieber thing as an example, and you kind of spoke about this, but, like, you know, I wondered, like, if you kind of had the ability to do the, quote-unquote, making music part of it and, like, kind of get out of it and disconnect and let it go wherever it's going to go. And it kind of sounds like you were able to do that with the other two guys that you were working with.
No, I mean, there was an A&R guy who was checking in with us every 20 minutes and saying, oh, that concept's not good. People won't think about that. That concept's not good. Let's change this lyric. We change this part. I mean, you know, you're just making license plates, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just, you're led to believe that you're making art, but you're just making, you know, like terry cloth robes. I mean, or whatever you're making. It's just, you're just creating something that needs to be created for the sole purpose of making, you know, money for, you know, all different kinds of people, the label, the publisher, the musician, or the artist. But I think we all kind of understand a little bit when we're in the room that we're either there because we failed at something else, or we're there because we just want to be able to fund our own thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ross went on to do this, like, fucking amazing play that he produced and wrote and performed himself in Los Angeles and New York that I went to go see. You know, he's a really creative, smart guy. But he also listens to that music, so he kind of gets it a little bit more than I do, which is probably, you know, why he's far more successful at it than I am. You know, I mean, these guys are really talented. When they do stuff on their own, they're you know, it's pretty badass. So, you know, I think there's lots of reasons why people do it. But, you know, when you're in the room and you're with these people, there's a little bit of a, you know, like a fraternal kind of feeling, you know, because they're probably not that different than you are as far as where they've come from and what they hope to gain.
So how did you go about, like, kind of getting your foot in that fraternal door at moment one?
Well, it just kind of landed in my lap. I was living in Los Angeles after finishing grad school, and my manager got a phone call from the Dixie Chicks saying they were making another record and they wanted me to come help them write it. So I went out to Texas and spent a couple days with them and a bunch of other writers, and that was the first time that I'd ever done any co-writing. So I didn't really know anything about it. And I was in the room with a bunch of other writers with some of the Dixie Chicks. And nothing really came of that other than I think they put a couple of those songs on a Dixie Chicks side project that was called The Courtyard Hounds, which is Marty and Emily without Natalie.
Right.
I just thought that experience was kind of amazing. I was like, wow, you can just, but that was not what, I mean, that's not normal. You know, I went and stayed at this like bed and breakfast outside Dallas, Texas with a bunch of other songwriters. We got together every morning, had breakfast. We went and wrote for a little while, then we go have lunch. And we laugh and, like, talk about our experiences. And it was almost like summer camp, you know?
And that's probably when you're with folks like Gary Loris at that point, too?
No, that was later. That was probably a couple years later.
Okay.
But that's another experience that was, you know, that definitely came of... that was another experience that's similar to the first experience that I had.
Yeah.
You know, okay. Me and Gary, my friend Sandy Keela, who I did the song for Nashville with, you know, we just sat around for, like, 3 days and hung out and wrote songs. And Gary Loris is like one of my idols. So that was like, you know, so there's been a lot of incredible experiences in songwriting. And so now when I do co-writing, I just try to do those. You know, I'm not in any position to like demand that it's any certain way. But when those opportunities come my way, you know, when Garrison Starr calls me to write, I'm always going to say yes. You know, when other people call me about, oh, you know, so-and-so's looking for this and so-and-so's looking for that, I'm just like, I'm not interested. Because it's just not fun. I don't want to sit in some shitty studio and write some terrible song for someone else who can't write it for themselves. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Fucking people should go write, they should go write their own shitty song. You know? but that being said, there's a long tradition that I am deeply connected to of songwriters writing songs for other people. You know, the Brill Building, Tin Pan Alley. I mean, these are things that have existed long before the quote-unquote singer-songwriter, long before Bob Dylan and that movement. You know, Aretha Franklin hardly wrote any of her songs. I mean, she's one of the most celebrated, and rightfully so, singers and performers of all time. You know, if you have an opportunity to write music like that for people like that, of that caliber, then I think that, you know, you can really do something. And, you know, what they were doing back then, too, is they were writing pop music. It was popular at the time. But I think the difference was that there was a certain amount of artistry that was required on the part of the performer and the part of the writer that almost eschewed, you know, the marketplace or A&R, any of those other things. Because there was something about, like, you really wanted to get at them, you know. And that's why you had things, you know, like, you know, it's why there was such a heyday for music coming out of Memphis, you know, because there were players there and writers and performers who were, you know, like, you know, who were really dedicated to the craft, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. With this new record, I mean, you've said you made the decision not to collaborate with other writers on this material because of the personal nature of the songs. And I wonder, did you find that, you know, opened up other things for you, you know, kind of working in that way?
I mean, really, that's certainly one reason. Another reason is that I just don't, just, people just slow shit down, you know, other people just slow shit down. And I wanted to just keep rolling. So that's why I performed, you know, wrote, performed, arranged, produced the whole thing myself, except for one bass track. But I mean, did that? Yeah, I mean, you get to dig pretty deeply into the production of stuff. you know, after the song is done, you get to dig in and kind of like, you're almost in a state of like twilight sleep or something, where you're just looking at the computer screen for hours and hours, moving stuff around, trying to make it sound a certain way and chasing down, you know, sounds. I mean, it's really fun. You know, that's like the video game part of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Where you just get to sit around and just like fuck with stuff for hours and hours. And when I'm in that place, I'm doing it for like, you know, stretches of like 14 hours of just sitting here, just working on it. It's just really fun and enjoyable. And it's definitely like a, you know, I've become kind of manic about it. So I don't know if I got anything out of it other than, or discovered anything new other than, oh yeah, if I put this drum, this kick drum on top of this kick drum, it sounds like the way I want it to sound. Yeah. If I double this guitar with this other guitar, it sounds cooler.
Yeah, and you've spoken about how some of the Damwell's material has tracks and tracks and tracks, and you're in your own home studio with similarly infinite tracking possibilities. So for you, how easy was it to kind of find the place with each of these songs where you could really cut the cord and call it done?
Pretty easy, I think. Some of them are, you know, were more difficult than others, but I mean, you know, there's a song in the record called "This Is the Last Song I'll Ever Write on Guitar."
Yeah.
And that song, yeah, you know, I don't know why, I just couldn't figure out how to make it sound the way I wanted it to sound. So that took like a couple, it took a couple tries, a couple kind of, let's sit down and work on this. Okay, let's put it away. Let's come back to it in a couple days. Let's come back to it in a week, you know. But like I said, the whole record was made from January 1 to February 18. So it wasn't like it took very long, you know, to get to a place where I could say a song was done. Most of the stuff just kind of came out, and it just felt like this is the where it should go. And you know what I mean? It didn't feel too difficult in that sense. Everything's so controlled in the box, you know. I mean, oh, it sounds too dead. Well, throw some reverb on it. Oh, it sounds too big. Okay, take the reverb off. You know what I mean? It's not like I got to contend or I have to fight the room, you know. Like, 'cause when you're making recording drums, you know, oftentimes you got to fight the room, you know, because you're in like a room that has an echo, it has a sound, and that the sound of that room is its own kind of sound. But you don't have to worry about that when you're making a record in your laptop, you know.
Yep.
If you need a bigger sound, you just go get it. So, yeah, that makes it way easier. And so I don't think I had to chase stuff for very long to make it finished.
Yeah, working on a record for a couple months, is that pretty quick for you?
I think it's pretty quick. I mean, yeah. I mean, considering that I wrote them during that time as well, it's just like this weird state of mania. I don't know if I'll ever be able to do that again. I don't know if that'll ever happen again. I mean, I did make another record right after that. It took a little bit longer. I don't know if it's as good. But that first record just came out. I mean, to be totally frank, you know, I don't know if I'll ever be able to do anything that's as good as this record. I'm usually pretty self-deprecating about my records, but I think this may be the best record I have ever and will ever make. I don't know. And I think the reason why I feel that way is because I had so little control over what was happening at the time. It was just happening. I wish I could explain it in a way that it didn't sound like some kind of hocus pocus ghost story, but it really felt like that to me. It felt like it was just happening. I just needed to be there.
Well, I loved the sound of the piano and Leonardo, and I wondered if that was like an actual like an upright or a sample. I guess I was curious if you had a certain like piano / keyboard sound in your head that you wanted for that one.
I think I was going for like an upright sound. Nothing is real on this record. There's no real piano. It's just guitars and vocals, and bass, I guess, is real. But all the other stuff is all programmed samples, all kinds of stuff like that. You know, I'm poor. I can't afford to let go mic up a piano. And I'm not a great piano player, so I need to be able to, like, move stuff around, you know, move notes around and stuff like that. But, you know, I think that's a combination of a couple different sounds. You know, I use this thing called addictive keys, because they have some pretty good piano sounds. There's also like Easy, I think it's like Easy Keys or something. There's another one. And then there's these other samples, these Alicia Keys samples. There's, you know, there's probably like a couple layered samples of stuff kind of happening in there. And then I think when it was mixed, it was reamped. So the mixer, Clay Blair, put the track through an amplifier and then recorded the sound coming out of the amplifier just to give it that kind of, you know, super compressed quality to it. You know what I mean?
It also has a big sound, though, which is, you know, I mean, that just shows, like, just the amazing things you can do, you know, with all sorts of stuff that might just all be on your laptop these days and in the mixing process, as you said. I mean, it's just like you've really got infinite possibilities at your disposal.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I think that for a while I was resistant to that. I was like, oh, that's cheating or something, but that's, I think that's stupid. You know, there's really no excuse for an artist not to create art anymore, you know, other than, you know, you gotta, I mean, even financial constraints is not even an excuse. I mean, most of the stuff I'm using are cracks, stuff that people gave me, or drums that I recorded myself or that someone else recorded in fucking Norway somewhere, and someone else got it from someone else who gave it to me. You know, I mean, there's just an infinite amount of material that you can use to you know, to mine your art. And then, you know, with like iMovie and all this other stuff, you can make your own music videos, you can edit your own art for your covers, for your albums, for your posters, for your t-shirts, whatever. I mean, you know, there's no excuse for anyone really out there who wants to be an artist. And so I think that you've got to use all those tools, and you've got to use them without hesitation and without any shame. You know, I mean, some of the drum samples on my records are like the same samples that were used on like Kesha's record. You know, I mean, I will fuck with them and do stuff with them to make them sound the way I want them to sound, but like, fuck those people. You know, I'm just using what I need to, mm-hmm. You know, and I'm using whatever's available to me. And I don't think anyone's going to listen to this record and be like, oh yeah, that's that Kesha sample or whatever, you know, or that sounds like a Kelly Clarkson sound or something. You know, I mean, I'm just using what I have. I mean, hopefully when you print that, these people won't come after me, but I'll just say I was lying. but, you know, I think you just have to, you know, you got to just steal and use whatever you need to. I mean, when, you know, I was just watching this movie, this documentary of Jean-Michel Basquiat, who's an artist from New York in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And before he became successful, he was just writing graffiti on the wall, you know? I mean, that's a crime, you know, but it was, there was something about it that was really beautiful because he just had to do whatever he had to do. There's this one scene where he walks into the restaurant and he pours the syrup on the table and starts making a painting with a fork, with the end, you know, with the tines of a fork into the syrup. And it's just like, yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, he didn't have a canvas, and all these things like the canvas or, you know, paints or acrylic or oils or whatever. I mean, that shit is expensive, and it's designed in a way to make art have to be a, you know, almost like an elitist thing. You know, well, you can't make a painting if you can't get the right canvas. And then when you get the canvas, you have to gesso it. And if you don't do those things, then you can't really be a legitimate artist, you know? Like, oh, well, if you're not going to record real drums, well, then, you know, you can't make a real record, you know? That's just the elite trying to hold on to the reins of the art so that other people can't make it, you know, so they can lay claim to it. And I just think you got to tell those people to go fuck themselves.
Yeah, for sure. So what I was going to do with this podcast was I was going to put, like, say, a song at the beginning of it and a song at the end. And so I wanted to ask mm-hmm. you about those. First off, the song that you just premiered, Odex Girlfriends, that's one that doesn't seem lyrically like it unfolds chronologically. So I kind of wondered what your process was for putting that together in a way that felt right for you.
It's interesting. I was just thinking about that the other day. I was trying to remember which verse I wrote first. The first verse in the song that you hear is not the first one that I wrote. I think the first one that I wrote was probably the verse about Laura. Mm-hmm. Laura was the girl in the boy's pants. and I think I just put them together in a way I don't even know why, to be totally honest. But I think ultimately I wanted Elizabeth to be the last one. She was not the last one in the first, writing of the song. She was, I think she was like, you know, the second or third one. But she had to be the last one, just because I think that, the sort of arc of the song is not the same as the arc of the actual events as they took place in reality.
This is the last song that I'll ever write on this guitar. You talk about obviously selling a beloved guitar to a fan. And I wondered, is that something you let go on one of these crowdfunding campaigns?
I let go of it before that, actually. It wasn't a crowdfunding thing. It was just I went on Facebook and was like, hey, I'm selling this guitar. Anybody interested? so it wasn't part of a crowdfunding thing.
Yeah, I often wonder, you know, about some of the incentives you see attached to some of these campaigns, you know, from artists and, you know, the sentimental attachments that folks might have to some of those items. So, I mean, this song, like, even not necessarily being like that, certainly feels like an artist writing about the process of letting something go like that. I mean, certainly, you know, as you hear in the song, there's a lot that you have attached to that guitar.
Yeah, for sure. I get pretty attached to things. I don't know why it is that I feel more attached to things than I do to people often. Probably just because things don't complain. I mean, I was pretty attached to that guitar, and I didn't even realize how attached I was to it until I had to sell it, you know. I wrote a bunch of stuff on it. Just like the song says, you know, I played it on some records over the last 10 years. It provided a nice rhythm track that I'm sure most people couldn't hear.
I mean, anybody that's a player, they know a Martin's a nice guitar.
Yeah, it was a nice one. It was a D35 from the 70s. You know, it had some, like, changes and stuff that had to be made to it. Some, I think it was a neck reset or something. But, it was a beloved instrument that is now in the hands of, you know, Brian Sheary, as the song says.
So, with this record coming out here in February, what's your plan once this record's out? Are you going to go out and play shows? What's the plan?
Yeah, I'm going to go out and play shows. I'm going to do all that stuff. I don't know if, I mean, I think a lot of them will be house shows. I think a lot of them will be, opening for other people maybe, or I don't know. The landscape of touring has changed so much over the last, 15 years. You used to make a record and just go out on the road forever. And now I don't know if that's how people do it anymore. So, you know, I have a bunch of house shows that I have to play because people have bought them as exclusives on Pledge and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I got to go do those for sure.
And then beyond that, I mean, the record that you talked about that's in the can, do you have an idea? Like, you know, I think you mentioned that's going to come out maybe later this year.
Yeah, that's the hope. You know, I just want to keep kind of moving ahead. But then I'm afraid that, wow, shit, what if I can't write another record this year? Then I'm going to put out two records this year and none the next. So I don't know. I kind of just want to keep going. I don't know where I'm going, but I want to keep going there.
Well, beyond all that, what else is on your slate of things that you have coming up that you're working on?
I just did this stuff for Palabolas, this dance company in New York. Right.
Oh, is that musical?
Yeah, it was. It's basically it's not a musical, but it's a choreographed dance piece.
Right, right.
And I wrote the music to it, and sort of the soundtrack, I guess, would be more accurate. I think I'm doing more stuff for them. I don't know when that's going to happen. I know they're putting together another show, and then there's other stuff I'm doing this year. I think I'm in the process of putting together a new band of sorts with my friend Billy Harvey and my friend Celine Nirala.
Cool.
Because we do this thing in Texas where we'll play, like, we'll just do this trio show where we kind of play on each other's stuff, kind of go around robin and play songs. And then we thought about, like, maybe we should, like, record music together. So I think we're going to do that this year, which would be a lot of fun. And we're going to call the band Nirala Harvey Deason because that's the stupidest title for a band ever. But that's our last name, so can't blame us.
Oh, that's very cool, man. And I guess final bit here, I know that you now in the recent past here have been going back and forth to Cleveland occasionally for holidays. What's your favorite thing to do while you're here, besides get out of the airport?
Well, you know, I was stuck in Cleveland for two nights over this recent holiday.
Exactly.
Because the United had, like, bumped our flight or something because of weather in Chicago. I love Cleveland. I just love the Midwest. And I think I love it because there's just no fucking bullshit. I mean, there's a lot of bullshit, but not, like, the kind of bullshit there is here. Here, there's, like, I mean, even just going to the grocery store, there's fucking bullshit. You know, you got to deal with, you know, some fucking person in a car they can't afford taking up two parking spaces, you know. I mean, everyone here is like a walking S corporation. You know, it's just, it's brutal. You know, everyone's got something to sell. And I feel like, you know, in the Midwest, there's a little bit more of a, I don't know, maybe a little bit more in touch with reality as it's taking place, you know, as opposed to the reality that you perceive in the future, you know, mm-hmm. for yourself.
Yep.
There's a lot less fiction to people, I think, in the Midwest. But, you know, look, there's plenty of weirdos everywhere. I think it's probably something about the weather, because you know that there's going to be, you know, 4 or 5 months of absolute bitter cold.
Right.
You know, you're like, you're not as impressed with someone's tan line. You know what I mean? You're not as impressed with, like, someone's, you know, $2,000 pair of shoes. So I don't know. I always like coming back there. And, you know, I lived in Iowa for 2 years when I was in grad school, and, you know, that was just a great time. It's just so simple. So I don't know. I always like going back to Ohio.
Well, final bit here, and that just is there anything we didn't cover you want folks to know about?
No, I think we probably covered more than I want folks to know about.
All right, man. Well, thank you very much for the time.
This is the last song I'll ever write on this guitar. Sold it to a fan on the internet, I can't afford it anymore. It's a D35 from 71 made by the Martin Company. But that can never begin to explain what it means to me. I think it was in Baltimore in 2002. I never owned a Martin, but Neil Young played one on Harvest Moon. It had a strong and warm tone when I played that open C, and I hope it sounds as beautiful in the hands of Brian Sheary. I should have played it more. Instead I left it in the case. Maybe blowing in the wind was waiting in there, all helpless, but I'll never know. It's too late. This is the last song I'll ever write on this guitar. I sold it to a fan on the internet, I can't afford it anymore. It's a D35 from 71 made by the Martin Company. But that can never begin to explain what it means to me. I played it on some records over the last 10 years. It provided a nice rhythm track that I'm sure most people couldn't hear. But when I moved to Iowa, the bridge had started to crack in the cold basement where it was left. And I still feel bad about that. It could've used new strings or an F-sharp over A. Maybe here comes a regular was waiting in there on Blackbird, but I'll never know, 'cause it's too late. This is the last song I'll ever write on this guitar. I sold it to a fan on the internet, can't afford it anymore. It's a D35 from 71 made by the Martin Company. That can never begin to explain what it means to me. I hate to see you go, but you'll be fine, I know. I'll hold on to the times we had, like I do with cars and apartments and everything else, 'cause everything else makes me sad. This is the last song I'll ever write on this guitar. I sold it to a fan on the internet, I can't afford it anymore. It's a D35 from 71 made by the Martin Company, but that could never begin to explain what it means to me.